ed teacher, a business education teacher, as well as three members of the support staff that their contracts were likely not to be renewed. The cuts are part of an effort to erase a nearly $800,000 projected budget shortfall. Administrator Scott Pierce said program enrollment was used to determine staffing levels for the next school year. And more than 20% of teachers in the Delavan-Darien School District will apparently lose their jobs because of a failed referendum recently. And an elementary school is slated to be closed as well. Coming up on 10 and a half minutes now after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. Major League Baseball, Brewers lost their broke their losing streak by beating Cincinnati 6-5 yesterday. Cubbies beat Colorado 3-2. The White Sox were off. Tonight now, the Brewers play again in Cincinnati. Cubs host the Rockies again down at Wrigley. White Sox play in St. Louis. NBA playoffs, Boston beat Philadelphia 117-101 last night. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Tuesday, May 1st. What a beautiful day. Mostly sunny, warm, and windy. A high of 83 inland, 78 near Lake Michigan. Winds 10 to 25 miles per hour today. Here are the new numbers just in. Wind from the south-southwest at 15. 65 degrees in Racine, 64 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the morning show comes from UW Parkside. Build a career as a licensed professional counselor and mental health wellness advocate with the new Master's in Mental Health and Counseling from Parkside. Visit uwp.edu. Support also comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, I'm sure many of you are aware of the fact that on the 19th of May, Prince Harry of Wales is going to be married to his American girlfriend, Meghan Markle. And this is an occasion that has generated quite a bit of conversation. And it is also safe to say that a couple of generations ago, such a move would have generated enormous controversy if such a move would have even been deemed possible. And that's part of what is explored in a really interesting new book called American Princess, The Love Story of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. And it's written by Leslie Carroll, who is well known for a number of different books that she has written, including a number of books about European royalty, including the book Royal Romances. And this book, again, is titled American Princess, The Love Story of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, published by William Morrow. Leslie Carroll, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
This is maybe an unnecessary question, but nevertheless, I'm curious to know if anything in particular has spurred your interest in royalty and spurred you to write so many interesting books about it. I mean, it is an interesting topic, but has anything in particular drawn you to it?
I grew up in New York City, but my grandmother on my father's side she used to boast about how we had an ancestor who was chief rabbi of London during the days of Queen Victoria, and another ancestor who was secretary to the Viceroy of India. And so I kind of grew up with the idea of the Victorian age and kings and queens and princes floating around in my head. And I was drawn to it because of my own English background. So I started exploring it after writing women's fiction and historical fiction. And it was a fascinating topic to me because as Americans, we kind of live vicariously through Britain's royal family. We're fascinated by it. Even though we fought a war to get rid of it, we're drawn to it.
Isn't that interesting? It really is something. As I mentioned in the introduction, this intriguing and in so many ways lovely story of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle is a story that would not have played out at all in the same way a generation or two ago. Just remind our listeners about just how utterly forbidden such a marriage once upon a time would have been, and actually not all that long ago.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, Harry and Meghan's romance checks off just about every box that would have been taboo. We'll run down the boxes, and then we can go back generations. First of all, she's the first biracial bride to marry into the British royal family. And, of course, she is American, and there's nothing in Britain's constitution that says you can't be American. But the very phrase American divorcee used to send shudders through the British royal family. She is an actress, and for centuries, actresses weren't even considered acceptable as royal mistresses. And, of course, this is just different for a British royal bride. Kate is the only other college graduate to be a royal bride. And Meghan is a career woman in her own right for years, and she's politically outspoken, and she's also 3 years older than Harry. But we can go back to the fact that being divorced, of course, it was Henry VIII who broke with the Church of Rome in the first place, and then being divorced was considered a taboo for years. And Edward VIII, who wanted to marry Wallace Simpson, when you're king, you're head of the church, and you can't marry a divorced person, the church didn't even recognize divorce. And Charles couldn't marry Camilla for years because she'd been through the divorce courts, and only recently did the Church of England change its position on divorce. And Charles himself hadn't been able to marry Camilla, who was originally his lady love, because she wasn't a virgin, and she didn't come from an aristocratic family. And so he was more or less railroaded by his own father into marrying Lady Diana Spencer, who was just about the only teenage virgin they could find, and who came from an old, established, aristocratic British family. So the very idea, and they only had 13 chaperone dates, so theirs was really one of those old-fashioned, manufactured courtships, as opposed to Meghan and Harry, which is a real love story. Those two fell in love with each other. So even that is unique.
That it's a genuine love story and not more of an arranged situation
more
or arranged,
an arranged
relationship.
Marriage. And American Princess even covers what a love story that might have been when the Queen's younger sister, Princess Margaret, fell in love with her father's equerry who had been through the divorce courts in the 1950s, Group Captain Peter Townsend. Even though he wasn't the one who instituted the divorce, the monarch has to sanction a marriage. It's an act that goes all the way back to 1772 when King George's sons were entering into misalliances with unsuitable women, namely actresses. Two of them fell in love with actresses, and the king said, this is so not going to happen, and instituted an act where any of the descendants actually of King George II had to request the monarch's consent to marry. And that act is still in effect. Harry had to request his granny's permission to marry Meghan. So now, over 300 years later, the Queen actually gave her consent to Harry to marry an actress.
I wonder if you could just say a word, and I wish we had more time for this, because this is one of the things I most enjoy about your book. Sketch for us a portrait of Prince Harry, because I think you do a marvelous job of shaping a detailed portrait of who he is and what makes him such an exceptionally compelling and also admirable figure.
Thank you. One thing that I just will say quickly is what sets American Princess apart from the other books that are coming out on the market is that it is a double biography of Harry and Meghan. So we see in alternating chapters the story of both of their lives to see how much they are alike or not. Harry has this wonderful arc. We see the wild child who is a child of divorce, and he hears his parents fighting, and it's a terrible thing when he's a little kid and they separate and he grows up in two separate households, his father's on the weekends, his mother's in Kensington Palace, and he has a terrible time coping even with that. And then, of course, his mother dies so tragically when he's only 12 years old, on the brink of adolescence, and has no coping mechanism because he's a prince. And there's no one there. His father is finally able to be with Camilla, which was his lifelong dream. And you have poor Harry, who is basically with protection officers in loco parentis. And those men are there to save his life in case something happens, not there to be a parent to say, oh, I'm sorry, Your Royal Highness, this is a bad idea. So poor Harry is left to booze it up and to try marijuana and to start smoking cigarettes as a teenager. And he's left to figure things out on his own, which he can't do because what teenager can when he's lost his mother? And the British ethos is keep calm and carry on, suck it up. The Queen's motto is never complain, never explain. And the royals are not permitted to show emotion in public. This poor little boy, and we've all seen the footage, was not permitted to cry in public after his mother died so tragically. So we watch Harry going through this horrible, horrible teenage phase of his life with no ability to get through it and no understanding even of why he's acting out this way. And he goes through Eton and he figures out, oh, I like the army. I like this kind of stuff. And he gets into Sandhurst and he becomes an army guy and realizes this is what I'm good at. I'm not an academic, I'm an army guy, and he really enjoys being one of the lads. He doesn't enjoy the trappings of royalty. And that's part of what gets his head together, and it isn't until last year when he participates in a charity that he helps put together with William and Kate called Heads Together, which again is groundbreaking for the British monarchy because never, again, a generation ago, would you be talking openly about mental health and why it's important to discuss that you have psychological issues. Harry came clean on a radio podcast saying, I went and sought counseling, not until my late 20s, and realized that all my anger and all of my wild behavior was due to my inability to cope with the death of my mom.
Hmm.
And I recommend this for everybody there. And once you come clean and once you say, I had a hard time coping, I needed to talk to a therapist. And that's what got me through it. You realize there are a whole lot more people out there than you know. And I believe, and he was encouraged by William to do this, and that was recently, and I think that Meghan was also the other person by his side who said, Harry, talk to the world. Tell the world you did this.
Right. And of course,
you have no idea how many people are going to say, oh, my God, me too. And I think also this helped open up Harry. Once, oh, God, shrinks always say you have to love yourself before you can love someone else. But I believe this opened up Harry to finding the right woman for him, who was as kind and compassionate as Diana was. And I always say, you know that phrase, men marry their mothers? Well, for Harry, in this case, with Meghan, it was in the bag because she's the kind, compassionate humanitarian that Diana was, and huggy and warm. And Harry's huggy and warm.
There are a lot of ways in which this works really well. You did mention the fact that Meghan Markle has been politically active and also outspoken. Do you have any concerns that this is an aspect of who she is that could potentially complicate her standing, maybe get her in trouble? Or does she seem to have a really good sense of what to say when and how to say it?
Yes and yes. When she was sitting with William and Kate and Harry when they were speaking about the umbrella of their charities forum and she mentioned the Me Too movement, and there was this backlash, oh my God, Meghan actually said that, and royals don't go there, and all of that. There seemed to be a 24-hour blip on the radar screen, because royals are not supposed to express a personal political opinion, which has never stopped Prince Charles. But people don't like it when Prince Charles natters on about organic farming or modern architecture or whatever. They just think he's sort of an old crockpot by this point. But with Meghan, I have a sneaking suspicion that she is going to modernize the monarchy more than the monarchy is going to rein her in. Because she does not come across as strident or militant. And I think the causes that she's advocating, I just read recently that one of the things that she was advocating, first Kensington Palace said, all of the charities that she was advocating, forget it. She has to start with a clean slate under the umbrella of Harry and William's charities. But I just read that one of the ones that she's had been advocating for, and was one of the women and girls charities, seems to be sneaking under Harry's umbrella, which is something I thought might happen. So I don't think she's going to kind of be out there grandstanding, but things like the Me Too movement, things like women's and girls' advocacy for economic and educational opportunities globally, because a number of those countries that Meghan had been in South Asia, for instance, or in Africa, were Commonwealth countries. And Harry's now the Commonwealth Youth Ambassador. And youth charities were important to Meghan as well. She's been walking that walk and talking that talk for years in her other profession, in addition to being an actress. So I have a feeling this is going to slowly sneak back in. I don't think they're going to put the brakes on her as much as people might have thought.
Right. Author Leslie Carroll's new book is called American Princess. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's part two. And what a pleasure and honor for me to be speaking with one of the world's most beautiful and most stylish women, India Hicks. She is the...
That's very generous.
She's the daughter of a famed British decorator, David Hicks, and the daughter of Lady Pamela Hicks. And I want to begin by asking you about your parents and to what extent the woman you are today, both as an entrepreneur and in terms of your own distinctive sense of style, how much of that can we trace to them and to the life that you had with them?
That is a really interesting question. And I'm so glad we've started with that. How that's given me a pause to think. I think an awful lot. I am exceptionally close to my mother, who was an extraordinary character and is an extraordinary character. She is 88, and I am literally two fields away from her right now. She's just in her own home across the road. And she has had really a front row seat at many extraordinary events. She was with the Queen the moment the Queen became Queen. She was a lady in waiting. She went on that amazing Royal Commonwealth tour. She was out in India with my grandfather, who was the last viceroy. So that meant that when India was being handed back from Britain to be independent, my mother was there. So she sat with Mahatma Gandhi in prayer meetings. She then married my father, who was completely mad, very vibrant, very flamboyant. They lived an extraordinary life as my father dazzled the world with his incredible color schemes and geometric patterns and his incredible eye for design. So both of my parents were individually very unique and very, very broad-minded in their thinking. And I would like to think or hope that I got the best of both of them. So I'm very passionate about design, but I'm very aware about hopefully about giving back and being loyal and being dutiful and just being grateful for the extraordinary life that I have been blessed with.
Nicely put. I want to quote something that your mother said in an extraordinary documentary a number of years ago called The Windsors, which was about the history of the royal family. And in talking about the current queen, your mother, Lady Pamela Hicks, I remember her saying, you know, a lot of people would wonder, to be queen. Oh, you know, wouldn't that be the most wonderful thing? Yes, maybe for a day, but for a lifetime? I mean, and, you know, she's suggesting that kind of a life when it is your entire life is actually an extraordinary responsibility and burden. And I can see what you are saying when your mother clearly has a sense of duty and honor and integrity, and obviously that's something that is very much a part of who you are as well.
Well, I would like to think so. My mother was close to the Queen and did have an insight into our extraordinary sovereign. And I think my mother is right. Imagine that is something that is duty beyond to have a lifetime of working for your nation, for your country. And my mother is an extraordinary example of someone who has always been forward thinking in the same way that our Queen is. I think that the modernization of the monarchy in England is something that we should all feel proud of. I think the work that those boys, Harry and William, are doing at the moment is exceptional. And I think it's an exciting time. It's interesting that I've very much chosen a life out of England and that I've based and founded a company that's in America. And I have really had the most extraordinary experiences traveling across your great country, meeting amazing people, seeing very diverse backgrounds, and your history also is quite remarkable.
I want to ask you just one question about Princess Diana. You were a bridesmaid at her wedding. I wonder, when you think about her sense of style and the way she carried herself, and particularly once she sort of surmounted some of those difficulties when she was so young and in the spotlight and became such an admired woman, I wonder what lessons you feel like you maybe learned from her in whatever respect is significant.
Another quite hard question. I think Diana was exceptional, as we all know, in many ways. She had what we all can recognize was star quality. When she walked into a room, you took notice. Now, are you born with that, or do you learn that? Who knows? But I think she was blessed with great looks, an extraordinary charisma, a human touch, great style. And I think all of that combined made her the person she is. What was interesting was what she did with that, and that she didn't sit still, and she took it and used it for the greater good. I think, though, that we must never forget how hard Prince Charles also works, and that he is also a man of deep passion and understanding, and is very, very involved with so many exceptional causes in England and globally. And I think just being part of the royal family, they do have a sense of duty, and the fact that they do need to take the what has been given to them and use it to the better. Diana was a particular example and character. And I think, you know, 20 years on, as we now mark the anniversary of her death, we should see it more as a celebration and less as mourning the loss of her, and see the example that she set.
India Hicks was a bridesmaid for the wedding of Princess Diana and Prince Charles. India Hicks's mother, Lady Pamela Hicks, was a bridesmaid for Queen Elizabeth II for her wedding. More information about India Hicks and her company is at indiahicks.com. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. And at 8:33... here's part three of today's program. This is from the Morning Show Archives. And with Mother's Day almost upon us, I am really excited that for a few minutes I can speak with a very talented writer who has produced an absolutely wonderful, entertaining, heartwarming book, and it is called Waiting for Birdie, A Year of Frantic Tedium, Neurotic Angst, and the Wild Magic of Growing a Family. And this is a book by Catherine Newman, who is the author of a book that perhaps you've seen called Bringing Up Ben and Birdie, that you've perhaps seen that is a journal on babycenter.com. She contributes to Family Fun magazine, and maybe you've seen her writing in other places as well. And this is one of the very, very best books I have ever read to really step inside the experience of parenthood, which is...
Thank you.
I've really enjoyed this a lot. The book is published by Penguin Books. Catherine Newman, welcome you.
Thank you so much. What a lovely introduction.
Well, I really did enjoy this book, and you're speaking to someone who is not a parent and not likely to be, except to a Cocker Spaniel and a Golden Retriever. So I am really glad that whenever a book comes along that kind of helps me understand this experience so much more.
Well, thank you for saying that. That's great. I, you know, kids and pets have, of course, more in common than anyone likes to admit. But
certainly true. as I picked up your book, I was reminded of something that a very close friend of mine said as she soon completed her, I believe, first pregnancy successfully. I remember Allison saying that no one had prepared her for how long 9 months was, and that there aren't a whole lot of things in our lives that last 9 months. And you know, someone at a glance might be amazed that that one could write a book that would carry us through that experience, but there is so much that happens.
It's so true. You know, it's as is perhaps too obvious to mention, we live in a world where there's almost nothing you have to wait for anymore, for good and for bad. And so instead of popping your letter in the mailbox and having that sigh of relief and feeling like, okay, it'll take a week to get there, it'll take them a week to write me back, and I should get a letter back in a week, you send an email, and within a minute, you already owe another email. And everything, you want your Cracker Jacks at 3 in the morning, you can drive out and get them. Anything you want, it's so immediate. Everything's open around the clock. Everything happens now. And I do think pregnancy feels like an experience from another part of history. It's, you can't rush it. It happens at its own pace. And there are honestly so few things that are like that now. And I think for all of us growing up with all of this technology and this rushing and the speed, I think there's something incredibly moving about having an experience that you don't control.
Right. One of the things that, of course, made this especially interesting is that you're talking about, at least at most points in the book, you're talking about your second pregnancy,
right,
with a young toddler already on hand. And so this is kind of a dual adventure for you and your husband.
Yeah, it's true. You know, that was really a surprise. I think with the first pregnancy, there's so much romance around the pregnancy, and you just, it's like you're in love with the idea of having a baby, and everything is, you know, every minute you're putting your partner's hands to your belly, and it's so romantic. And the second time, you are already in the thick of a full-blown romance with the born child, the child who's already in your life, and the pregnancy feels both thrilling and also vaguely like an interruption. Which is something I would feel guilty about saying, except, of course, as soon as the baby's born, you don't have that feeling about it. But when I was expecting her, our baby Birdie, I was worried about sort of screwing up a perfect life, is what I felt like.
Hmm.
Which, of course, turns out not to be the case, or not permanently to be the case. You know, the beginning's a little dicey.
One of the things that was an interesting observation for you is when you said that you feel like people warn you about all the wrong things. They warn you about certain things that are going to be a part of pregnancy,
right,
but they don't necessarily really get to the heart and soul of what is going to be most challenging or most bewildering.
That's true. I do feel like that. And I continue to feel like that, although it hasn't helped me in talk to people who are expecting a baby. There are these kind of things that everybody says to you when you're pregnant, which is negative things that people are inclined to say to you, you know, like on the bus, people you don't even know, and they say things like, oh, you'll never have sex again, and you'll never go to the movies, and oh, you'll never sleep, and you'll be so tired, and it's all true. All of those things are true, and they are not the things that are really challenging, or at least not for me. I think you spend so much of your energy expecting this set of challenges that actually turns out to be in some ways incredibly superficial and manageable. The diapers, the crying, and what turns out for me not to be manageable at all is to be suddenly flooded with a kind of love that was like nothing I'd ever known, and that made me in its wake feel just incredibly vulnerable. And that I still am learning, honestly, almost every day to live like that, to live with this feeling of loving somebody so much that you are every second vulnerable to fear and anxiety, and things happen to kids, and we know that they do, but you can't live like that. You have to let them be kids.
It reminds me of a very poignant moment in the book, too. I mean, we should say this book is also hilariously funny. I mean, it's probably hilariously funny more than it's anything, but it also certainly has its really poignant and very thought-provoking moments. And one of them, I think, is when you say, having a kid makes me want the world to be a better place. I think that speaks to what you were just now talking about,
right.
Sort of the fear that is also at the heart of being a loving, attentive parent.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, I think it's true. I think that kind of fear, and it's a feeling everyone should have anyway. And I was somewhat embarrassed to be caught out having it, you know, simply because I'd given birth to a child. But I think it's true. I think, you know, there's a cliche, which is that, you know, if mothers ran the world, there'd be more justice. And I don't think that's specific to mothers, but I do think there's something very motivating about it. It gives you a feeling of actually wanting to be more politically involved simply because it matters so much.
Port that we have
Speaking of poignant, another moment that I thought was really neat. This is more about, as you talk about your toddler, Ben, and you talked about the experience you had over and over of wanting to count your blessings, particularly in the wake of a new mama's group, which would meet every Tuesday. Tell our listeners about that.
It is, honestly, it's the right theme for me to sort of bang away out here, this feeling of anxiety and gratitude, because that has been my particular education around parenting. And we used to get together, this mama's group, you know, there were like 10 of us with our weepy infants and our weepy selves, and we would eat and eat and eat and eat, and after there was not one scrap of food left, we would get to talking and people would say how tired they were. And then inevitably the conversation would turn towards someone's neighbor's uncle's, you know, step cousin who someone had heard about, who was a baby and sick with a mysterious illness or maybe dying or an accident someone had heard of. And these stories would come up every week and we would all cry our eyes out about this or that tragedy. And I think it was just the phenomenon of coming to terms with this possibility. Or for me, there's this is just my own personal weirdness, but I always feel like you can't look away from it. If you look away from it, it's almost like, I feel like if you look away from it, you are missing the point, that the point is really, in a way, the point is compassion, and to think about what loss feels like, not to brace yourself for it every second like we were doing then, which I think is not really a way you can live practically in the world, but just to see that it's all around you.
You also mentioned the fact that for you it was a very poignant moment for your toddler, Ben, the moment when he became sort of fearful for the first time. You say that's such a sad thing in a sense compared to what actually can be a rather wild period in a person's life, sort of just as they're becoming a toddler, when they view the world so fearlessly, and every pan on the stove and every whatever, that moment when they begin to realize that the world is a scary and potentially dangerous place, there's something a little sad about that, and it sounds like in your son's case that was particularly hard because he's had some particularly acute fears.
He has, although it's funny, you know, you think, I think this is just true of life in general, where every original experience you take yourself to be having, at this point you could just Google it online and find out there are 10 million other people having your exact experience, which is a good and a strange thing. And it's funny that you mentioned that about Ben and his fears, because Birdie, his sister, is now 2, and she is just heading herself into this same, she's been as fearless as a noodle. You know, she just is sliding through life, just laughing, everything. The world is her oyster in the most beautiful way. Nothing to fear. She assumes everybody loves her, and everybody does. And just recently, she started waking up in the middle of the night in tears, you know, just beside herself, inconsolable, terrified. And that is just heartbreaking all over again. It really does remind me of when the same thing happened to Ben. And you know, if you could give your child anything, in a way, it would be fearlessness. It would be the ability to move through the world assuming that you will be received with open arms and warmth and love and safety everywhere you go. And obviously that's, you know, it doesn't mean that you can't convince your kid that he won't be sucked down the tub drain, which, of course, luckily, you know, however scary the world is, you can still talk your kid out of most of their fears because they're, luckily for them, not really worried about the right thing. Hmm. So Ben was petrified, of course, that as the tub was draining, he would be pulled away down the tub drain, but he wouldn't get out of the tub for it to drain because he was so worried that maybe a toy had been left behind and that would be sucked down the tub drain. So he was this kind of petrified of the water, petrified of the drain, and then people made inopportune jokes about him getting flushed down the toilet, and it just turned into a whole, you know, it's right around when they're potty training, and the whole thing always, I think for everybody around that age, there's just a host of things you're, you know, reassuring them about.
It keeps it interesting.
There's really never a dull moment, except when it's so dull that you're clawing your eyes out with boredom. You know, those are the dull moments when
right.
you're playing Hi-Ho Cheerio for the 50th time in one day.
Well,
that's actually really dull.
Well, and yes, you talk about that more than once, so we think of it as a theme, not so much Hi-Ho Cheerio itself, but certainly the idea of kind of your intellect beginning to liquefy a little bit. And it sounds like that was one of the things that you weren't especially prepared for going in.
Yeah, it's true. I had not been prepared for that. And I think it's the kind of thing that people are right to not tell you about in a way, because what would you do? You know, would you try to like write your intelligent memoirs before the baby was born so you could refer to them later after you had not a single coherent thought in your head? I don't really know how you'd prepare. Maybe you'd label everything, you know, so you'd remember what its name was. But I was very surprised by that, by the, you know, with a new baby, you're incredibly busy, but nothing happens. And that learning to sit still, that was a real challenge for me. I am not a still person by nature. And there is nothing to do but learn to sit still. The baby falls asleep in your lap for 5 hours, and you are trapped there. And your best bet is to sit there and to try to still yourself, maybe read a book, and not be, you know, trying to get a million things done. And that I'm really grateful for. Not the boredom as much, which was my own thing. I don't think you have to be bored, but I, imaginary games, you know, with a toddler, it's not so much the thing that I look forward to. Reading a book to a toddler I love, but the, you know, you pretend you're the baby and I'm the mama, and oh, God, it's a little too much for me.
Well, I love the moment when you say that you remember all these times when Ben would sort of make these grand pronouncements of the most obvious kinds of observations, like I forget what.
Oh, like water comes out of the hose?
Yeah, right. Look, Mom, water comes out of the hose. And I suppose you feel like you need to greet each of these like this is.
That's great. It
yeah.
does. You're right.
Much appreciated information and insight.
He said this morning, he looked up from his eggs and said, when I'm old like Grandpa, which, you know, thank God my father's not there to hear. When I'm old like Grandpa, will my hair be white like that and also really short?
Mm.
And then you have to be like, well, white, maybe short. You know, that part's kind of up to you. But I think he imagines some aging process where you get older and older and your hair gets shorter and shorter. And then he said, but when you're old, you don't get any taller except on your birthday. And then you realize he moves through the world with this presumption that, you know, none of us are growing except maybe on my birthday I grow like another inch and a half. Which is such a, it's like a whole different worldview, and you only know the parts they think to share with you.
Mm.
You know, for all we know, he has a million completely bizarre ideas that we just know nothing about.
One of the things you talk about is the physical experience of pregnancy, and you tell us about how you really kind of learned a new meaning of the phrase sick and tired.
Oh,
and
God. That,
and for you, the second time around, I guess especially, your pregnancy was a lot of sick and a lot of tired.
It's so true. And, you know, I will say, you won't believe this, but I actually edited out pages and pages of descriptions of how sick and tired I was because I realized that it was just becoming incredibly tedious to read about it. And nonetheless, you know, you read 100 pages and all you get really is the fact that I'm exhausted and the fact that I'm, you know, throwing up every 5 minutes. But that is just what it is. And, you know, the thing about pregnancy, if you want to be pregnant, as I did both times, more or less, you know that it's finite and you know that it's for an incredibly blessed cause. And so I didn't, even though it's absolutely terrible, there's this way that it the whole time you know it'll end, or you assume it'll end, and you know it'll end happily. And that was, for me, I wrote about it a little bit in the book, but it was in quite stark contrast to a friend of ours who was undergoing chemotherapy at the right after I had Birdie. And,
wow.
And, you know, the similarities were a little bit uncanny, the exhaustion, the being really sick, but it was an illness. And I just kept thinking, that's why pregnancy is so lucky. You're sick, but you're not ill. You know what I mean? You feel lousy, but it's just in the service of something incredibly beautiful, which is not to say that I did not complain my head off while it was happening to me, because I, oh boy, did I complain. You know, I practically made Michael move to a different state from me because I couldn't stand the smell of the pesto he made in the blender. You know, it ruined my life for like a week.
That reminds me too, you like to talk about how when one talks about pregnancy, it shouldn't be about pregnancy cravings. It should be about pregnancy revulsions.
Cravings is such a positive spin. I feel like that's like some weird PR that's been foisted on us by somebody about, you know, it's such a spin job. People don't have, it's like, oh, maybe I could choke that down. And then it gets labeled a craving. You know, I love that. It's like, that is so far from a craving. You know, maybe I could keep that in my stomach for 10 minutes, you know, and then, oh, it's a craving.
As your pregnancy ends, you end up having, you know, a sense, essentially your delivery scheduled.
Right.
It's not a delivery that you just sort of wait for, but it is a pregnancy, I guess we would say, that is induced or... Oh, wait, I actually don't remember now. Did you have a C-section?
With Birdie, I actually had a scheduled C-section.
Mm-hmm. And I remember you saying that one of the things that was disconcerting as you went to the hospital that last time was when you were kind of told about various procedures and had to sign that form that indicates yeah. that there is the risk that something really bad could happen. And
yep, and that's totally fine with you. You basically sign a form that says, you know, I know that you might screw this up in the worst possible ways, but, you know, go ahead, do your best. Yeah, no, that wasn't, you know, I feel like they should have different forms for the really neurotic people. You know, like the regular people can just sign the regular form and not read it so carefully. But people like me, I think they need to have a form that's really, really gently worded that, you know, while we know in a billion years nothing truly awful would ever happen to you because it never, ever does. Nonetheless, you know, we ask you. But I just got the regular form.
Well, and apparently you also got an OB that was unsettling to you. I just have to read this paragraph. You said, when I went in for my last checkup, the OB I know least well there examined me, then rattled off a list of surgical risks from a form I was supposed to sign. The form said, in essence, I, the undersigned, understand that I'm likely to die during the surgery, and I feel fine about that. You know, and sign your name. Let me just say, this was not a shining moment of grace and reassurance. The OB reminded me, in fact, of one of those teenage waitresses who looks out the window chewing gum while she lists the salad dressing choices. Ranch, Parmesan, peppercorn, blood clots, hemorrhage, infection, acute infection, creamy garlic. Consider my confidence unboosted.
Yeah, well, there was that. This is the same OB, and because this is airing in Milwaukee, I have no particular fear about mentioning this. I probably wouldn't say it locally, but this is the same OB who, right before the surgery, you know, they like to, I had had a C-section before, and they like to try to cut where there is already a scar so that you don't have two scars. And she drew a blue line where she meant to cut. And this is, I swear this is true. She draws the blue line. She says, ah, crap. And then she says, ah, well, let's just go with it. Just like that. Mm. In front of me.
Wow.
I felt like, oh, God, take the 1 minute and, you know, rub it off with a towel and draw it again. No, that was it. She just went with the line she drew. You think that must be the first thing they learn in surgery is not to be like, ooh, shoot.
Yeah, don't, whatever you do, don't say that.
Right.
On top of it, if I remember correctly, your toddler, Ben, came down with strep throat much at the same time as Birdie's delivery.
Yes, you know, people say that you get a chance to learn over and over again whatever the particular lesson is you most need to learn. And I don't know if that's true, but it sure seems to be true for me where, you know, there I am with a newborn. I am the most sort of neurotic person about the kids getting sick. Ben comes to visit in the hospital, leaves, and within 5 minutes of leaving us is diagnosed at the pediatrician's with strep throat. And that was just, it felt like it was going to be catastrophic. He'd held the baby, he'd kissed her. And then it turns out the newborns don't get strep. So there you go. You know, it turned out it was okay. And there I was, panic-stricken and then incredibly grateful, which is basically my whole life. Panic-stricken and then incredibly grateful. Hmm. You know, it's not, it could be worse.
Right.
You know?
Well, and fortunately for you, everything went fine, or mostly fine, and in the wake of the birth, everything was fine. You had very little in the way of any postpartum blues. Like you'd had, a kind of a mild case of that after Ben was born. You say a little later in the book, I'm torn. I can't believe how well we're doing on the one hand, and on the other hand, how appallingly. And I'm sure a lot of young parents and new parents and even not so new or young parents have that feeling a lot, this strange dichotomy of doing well and doing terribly somehow.
It's exactly a dichotomy because it's like every cliche in the world. Roller coaster comes into your head 100 times a day. Just the word roller coaster, it just describes your whole life. Or, you know, highs and lows, toughest job you'll ever love, like all these horrible sort of hallmarky cliches. But it is so true that you've never been more high from love. It's exactly like falling in love. You are just, you can barely eat, you're so in love. You are just sick with it. You can't wipe the smile off your face. And then you are so exhausted and anxious and despairing that you just, you know, could leave your whole family and fly down to Brazil and, you know, never write home. It's such a bizarre mix of things, you know, where you can't wait for somebody to come and take the baby from you so you can shower, and then you rush out of the shower to get the baby back. It's completely insanity provoking. There's nothing, there's never been anything like that for me, truly. It's just, and I think that postpartum depression, a lot of it turns out to be more like anxiety, and it could be that I suffered from it more than I thought at the time, that a lot of my anxiety was actually really kind of hormonal and almost like clinical in nature. But luckily, it all passed.
Very good. And, you know, if there is an abiding theme which shows up in this book over and over again and right at the top and right at the end of your acknowledgments, it is gratitude. More than anything, you just seem
so
grateful.
I'm so glad you think that.
The book is Waiting for Birdie, A Year of Frantic Tedium, Neurotic Angst, and the Wild Magic of Growing a Family, published by Penguin Books, the author Catherine Newman. Catherine Newman, I love this book, and it was really fun to speak with you about it on the morning show. Thank you so much.
It was great, Greg. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm very excited to share with you an interview I recorded with author Ellen Meacham about a book called Delta Epiphany. It looks back more than 50 years to that memorable trip which then U.S. Senator Robert F. Kennedy took down to the Mississippi Delta. And there he met face to face some of the poorest Americans in the entire country and saw severe poverty at its very, very worst. It was a case of transformative energy, and Senator Kennedy was galvanized as he had not been galvanized before to pursue the issue of poverty in America. Ellen Meacham tells the story of this trip to the Mississippi Delta very thoroughly in her new book, and she even manages to track down some of the youngsters with whom Senator Kennedy spoke on that memorable trip, catches up with them all these decades later. Again, the book is titled Delta Epiphany, and we will talk about it on tomorrow's morning show.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, to lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional Morning Show co-host. Support also comes from UW Parkside. Build a career as a licensed professional counselor and mental health and wellness advocate with the new Masters in Mental Health and